Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Can Europe survive yet another nationalist challenge, this time from Poland? I ask Michel Barnier, former Brexit negotiator who's now running for president in France. Then...
Today, our children are three times more likely to see climate disasters uproot and unsettle their lives than their grandparents' generation.
As the clock ticks down to the next global climate summit, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen heads to India, seeking to get one of the world's major polluters to help turn the tide. Plus,
if we do stories that are relevant to people's lives, the way Puccini and Verdi and all those other guys did, people will probably see a feeling need to experience that.
Walter Isaacson talks to composer Terence Blanchard about bringing the African-American experience to the Metropolitan Opera at last.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Polexit, anyone? Yep, that term is tentatively being bandied around now since tensions in Poland started climbing to boiling point over European Union membership. The country's Supreme Court recently challenged the primacy of EU law over the Polish constitution. Tens of thousands of Poles took to the streets in protest over that, since 80% of the population wants to remain inside the EU, while the Supreme Court decision was led by judges local to the nationalist ruling Law and Justice Party. Meanwhile, here in the home of Brexit, the economic chickens are literally coming home to roost, with food industry supply chains in utter chaos, the British poultry industry, much like its oil and gas trucking and grocery industries, are severely disrupted by a labour shortage, partly because Brexit caused thousands of European workers to head for the exits. And my first guest tonight, Michel Barnier, was the EU's unflappable Brexit negotiator. And now he's laid out that experience in a new book called My Secret Brexit Diary. He's also running to be the next president of France and launching his own surprising critiques of the EU. So, Michel Barnier, welcome to our program. Let me first start by asking you whether you share the concerns about Poland and the current situation there. Do you think it can lead to an exit from the EU?
Good evening, Christiane, and thank you very much for your invitation. Yes, I can share the concern of a large part of the Polish people about what is on stake in Poland, in Warsaw, because what has been decided by the Supreme Court in Poland is very serious, rejecting or opposing the European Treaty, in particular the first article of the treaty, which is very serious. It is, in my view, much more a political issue and crisis than a legal one. And I think that the moment of truth is not very far. And I think that the European Council, the Council of the Head of State, will have in a few days or a few weeks, if there is no change in Warsaw, in Poland, to ask the key question to the Polish government, do you want to remain or not in the EU?
Well, they say they do want to remain, so it's quite interesting to understand what kind of a game they're playing. In addition, Hungary and the Prime Minister there, Prime Minister Orbán, who's challenged the EU on many issues, backs Poland's move right now. How much of a threat is this to the EU? You said in a few days, the moment of truth. Do you mean the moment of truth for the EU or for those countries?
There is a moment of truth for everyone. If you are willing to stay and to remain in the EU, we have to respect the principles, the values of the EU, exactly as the Polish government, the Polish people did 17 years ago, when it was the time of the accession in 2004, and they have accepted clearly the totality of the principle, of the values, and the content of our treaty. So that what is at stake is now just to know if they want to continue to respect our values and our principles, and in particular, on one point, the independence of the judges. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And that's obviously been an issue in Poland for many, many months now. Can I ask you a question? Your book, of course, is called it's called My Secret Brexit Diary, A Glorious Illusion. So what I want to ask you about is essentially your writing starts with a warning to the EU. Even though you were the negotiator very firmly, obviously, in the EU camp, you're basically saying the EU needs to change. It's very late in the day, but it's not too late. Tell me what you mean.
Yes, it's not too late. I spent 4 years, Christian, to manage this very serious event, which is the Brexit. And I think the Brexit is not a small event. It is a very serious and very historical event country, for the first time, I hope for the last time, leaving the EU and a great country, the UK. So my first chapter in this book was exactly to say that there is a warning for everybody. It's too late for the UK people for the moment, and it is not too late for us to listen to the people, to understand why 52% of the British people voted 5 years ago against Brussels, against the EU. Obviously, there are more British reasons for this withdrawal and for the Brexit, but there are also what I can call a popular feeling in UK, but also in many regions in Europe concerning the EU, the lack of protection, uncontrolled migration, the lack of jobs, no future. So we have to draw the lessons, to listen and to answer. All the answers are not in Brussels, obviously, but a part of the answer are in Brussels, a part of the answer are also in each capital, in my country in particular. This is why I recommend to everybody to change what needed to be changed to avoid new Brexit elsewhere.
So let me just ask you, if you can, briefly, if you had a magic wand and you could take your own warning and change one thing or reform one major thing, what would it be in the EU?
First of all, as everywhere, and I think it's true for Brussels, for Washington, or for Paris, to impose and to be careful about the responsibility of the politicians and not to avoid to give the power to the technocrats, first of all. It's true in Brussels, it's true in Paris, it's true in Washington once again. Number two, to be less naive in our trade relations with the US, with the Chinese. Number three, to build, as we are going to, we are beginning to do from the last 2 or 3 years, new capacity to be autonomous, to be independent. I think about the industrial policy, but also the cooperation in defense.
Okay, can I ask you to let's talk about my secret Brexit diary. You don't seem very impressed by the negotiating stance of the British team. About David Davis, who was the first negotiator with you, we rarely get into the substance of things. About Boris Johnson, you talk about how he wanted to employ the so-called madman strategy. So you seem to imply that they're not really in control of their brief, that it was a lot of ideology, a lot of just of talk. Explain a little bit how it appeared to you at the table.
Let me, Christian, just to mention the fact that I have a lot of respect for my counterpart. I have, in face of me, four negotiators in 4 years, but all along this long negotiation, very competent and professional member of the civil servants of the UK. But my feeling in the last 12 months, in particular with the new teams of Boris Johnson, is that I face in the other side of the table people who add much more ideology, rhetoric, political concerns than the usual pragmatism of the UK. And the paradox for French negotiating with British people is that I think that the pragmatism was not on the British side.
So are you surprised or not surprised then with what we seem to be experiencing right now in the UK, a bit of chaos, to put it bluntly or mildly, with, you know, supply chains and in the petrol stations disrupted, threats to turkeys that we eat for Christmas here, and all sorts of things, a gas crisis, at least created by the trucking crisis. Are you surprised by that, or did you expect this to happen?
No, to be frank, I want to say that I'm never happy when some countries, the EU or the UK today outside of the EU, are facing difficulties. I'm never happy. If you look with realism to these difficulties, we can see there are many reasons, not only one reason. The first one is the consequences of the COVID crisis. The second one is about the shortage of raw materials, which is a global problem for many countries, not only the UK. There are the price of energy, which is also a global concern for many countries everywhere in the world. And finally, there is objectively and obviously there are the direct consequences, the mechanical consequences of Brexit, because the UK, leaving the EU, has decided the end of the freedom of movement. This means that many workers, many drivers coming from the EU and are not ready to come back. And there are also many non-trade barriers, non-fiscal barriers for all the exchanges of goods between the EU and the UK. These are the mechanical and the direct consequences of the Brexit. This is the truth.
So now let me turn quickly to your run for the presidency of France at the centre-right conservative Republican Party, which was the party of certainly de Gaulle, well, Jacques Chirac and others. It's taken a bit of a knocking since the advance of Emmanuel Macron. The big parties are sort of kind of struggling to regain their feet. But I want to ask you this. You had said something, or at least it was translated as such, that seemed to indicate that you would call for or there needed to be a referendum on immigration in France. And this is what your old nemesis, Boris Johnson, who still feels triumphant, said this week at the Conservative Party conference.
Is it not a sublime irony that even in French politics, there is now a leading centre-right politician calling for a referendum on the EU? Who is now calling for France to reprendre le contrôle? It's good old Michel Barnier.
So tell us where you stand on all that. He's talking about a referendum on the EU. We understand that you had called for a referendum on the question of immigration. What are you calling for as a candidate for presidency?
Frankly speaking, this polemic is not serious. It's not correct. It is not the truth. I want to maintain the freedom of movement between the EU member states, including France. No way to seize or to interrupt this freedom of movement. It is exactly the contrary that the UK wanted and succeeded to do with Boris Johnson. So we are not on the same line. Johnson, Farage and some others wanted to leave the EU and campaigning with the Brexit to leave the EU. Finally, they won this vote, and it's exactly the country that I want for my country. I want my country to remain a strong European country. But at the same time, I want to change what needs to be changed and to draw the lessons of Brexit, what is exactly my line. And the referendum I've proposed on the immigration is just on specific points to get the possibility of a kind of a moratorium to change and to to be able to be more efficient to control the immigration coming from abroad, from third country, not from the EU. It is the big and the huge difference between the Brexiters and me, and I have nothing to do with these people.
So you said you wanted a moratorium on that aspect of immigration.
On some very specific aspect. Let me just recall, Christian, that the migration policy is a shared policy between the EU and the member state. I'm speaking of the migration coming from third country, Africa, Middle East or Asia, not coming from the EU.
Can I ask you to clarify your statements about the European Court of Justice? Because in your book, you say, nowhere else in the world is there a common legal order for an entire continent like the one we have built together over the past 60 years. There is no reason, no justification to accept a weakening of this community law. I read that you're defending the ECJ. But in a speech last month, at least it was translated as saying, all of the things you wanted to do, we cannot do all this without having regained our legal sovereignty. We can't be permanently threatened by a ruling or a condemnation at the level of the European Court of Justice or the European Convention on Human Rights. So which is it? Are you defending the ECJ and the European Court of Human Rights, or are you questioning their authority?
Now, obviously, I'm defending the ECJ. The single market, which is the key point at stake during this negotiation, because the UK tried every day to get the best of two worlds, is much more than a free trade zone. The single market is an ecosystem of rules, standards, regulation, supervisions, and at the top of everything, the ECJ. So we have to be very careful to maintain the role of ECJ, in particular when the single market is at stake, and no way to unravel or to fragilize the single market, as the UK tried to do during these negotiations. The key point is clearly what I mentioned previously. The migration policy is a shared policy between the EU, and I want to build a more stronger European migration policy. This policy does not work today. The Court of Auditors of the European level say exactly what I just said to you a few seconds ago. And I want to build a strong national policy, and we need to have more freedom to do that in the framework of a shared policy, once again, for the third time, between the EU and the member states. For the moment, there is no real sentences or word in our constitution and also in the European Treaty about Migration, that we need to improve these two points at the two levels.
Just very briefly and finally, you know, when you finally this deal happened on Brexit and everybody talked about a new relationship between the EU and Britain, are you surprised that almost every single aspect of this deal, not to mention the Northern Ireland Protocol, is being challenged by the Brits?
I think that the current UK government has to be very, very careful about what they want to decide about Ireland. We have negotiated this protocol on Ireland carefully, word by word, sentence by sentence, with Mr. Johnson, not without him or against him, but with him and with his team. So now what is at stake in Ireland, Northern Ireland, is not about goods, trade, technical issues. It's about peace and the people. And so I think and I hope that the current government of UK will be just in the situation to respect its signature, to be very careful about the Good Friday and Belfast Agreement, because what, once again, it's at stake is the peace and the people.
Michel Barnier, thank you so much for joining us. And turning now to tensions between Taiwan and mainland China, which are ratcheting up once again, with both sides engaged in a heated war of words, at least for the moment, their words. President Tsai Ing-wen, she marked Taiwan's National Day this weekend with a huge military parade and a blistering speech calling out Beijing's military aggression. And she vowed never to bow to that pressure. In turn, Beijing is accusing Tsai of inciting violence and distorting the facts, even as it renewed its commitment to complete reunification. This saber-rattling from both sides is escalating, and it does put President Biden in a tight spot. Correspondent Will Ripley is in Taipei with this story.
Taiwan's growing arsenal on full display at this weekend's National Day Parade. To defend against a growing threat from China, this small island is spending big on weapons, many made in the USA. F-16 fighters, Patriot missiles, $5 billion in U.S. weapons sold to Taiwan last year.
Thank you very much.
Taiwan arms sales skyrocketed during the Trump years. The former president's hardline stance against China, one of the few Trump-era policies embraced by President Joe Biden. Defending Taiwan's democracy against authoritarian China has rare bipartisan support. Some worry Washington politics may be provoking Beijing, even pushing Taiwan and the U.S. into dangerous territory.
If you do take steps to look like you are aggressively defending Taiwan, then you arguably put them in a more vulnerable position. You arguably, again, irritate China.
Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen says the island is on the front lines of a much bigger battle.
Free and democratic countries have been alerted to the expansion of authoritarianism, and Taiwan is on the forefront of the defense line of fellow democracies.
China sent a record 150 warplanes near Taiwan in just 5 days this month. Biden's balancing act, calming cross-strait tensions, defending democracy, and preventing a conflict that could cost American lives.
I've spoken with Xi about Taiwan.
I think Taiwan really presents a challenge to any American presidential administration because you're trying to balance competing interests.
This is an extraordinary sight. Four kinds of domestically produced missiles rolling through the capital in front of Taiwan's presidential palace, an ominous sign of escalating regional tensions.
We cannot control whether or not the Chinese Communist Party has the ability to attack Taiwan, but we are able to control and make sure it does not have the motivation to do so.
Every Chinese leader since Mao has vowed to take control of Taiwan. Analysts say President Xi Jinping may be the first with a military mighty enough to do it, even as he calls for peaceful reunification.
Whoever wins Taiwan wins the world.
China is locked in territorial disputes across the Indo-Pacific region. Taiwan, Beijing's biggest unresolved issue, and some say Biden's biggest test.
Will Ripley reporting there. Perhaps the biggest challenge for President Biden and Europe is maintaining cooperation with China on critical priorities like climate while still confronting Chinese aggression. And in just 3 weeks, world leaders meet in Glasgow, Scotland for COP26, that is the climate conference, where they'll reckon with a dispiriting report from the United Nations, which shows the world is in fact warming faster than scientists have previously thought. Meantime, China, the world's biggest polluter, is demanding its own coal mines boost their production. And India, the third largest polluter, is under pressure now to reduce its carbon emissions. The Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, is on a state visit to New Delhi right now. She's highlighting the urgency of tackling climate change while also trying to do whatever government wants to do, and that is maintain economic growth. So, Prime Minister, welcome to the program. You just heard our report from Taiwan. How concerned are you that you, who need to engage with China, as well as India, where you are, on issues like climate change, also might get caught up in these kinds of escalating tensions that are military and political tensions in China?
I would like to start by saying that fighting the climate change is the most important target, and therefore the way in front of us before we meet in Glasgow for COP26 should be about the climate change, and we need to focus our energy to find the necessary solutions. I totally respect and I'm totally aware of there are many other discussions that are needed and many other discussions that are very important, but from now on until we meet in Glasgow for the COP26, we need to focus entirely on the climate change and how to solve it.
So what about India? You've had, I think, several days, 4 days, to discuss this issue with Prime Minister Modi and his officials. India, as we know, and as you know, 70% of its electricity is from coal. They are on the brink of a, you know, energy crisis. And so far, it's generally taken that they're not meeting their carbon emission goals. What have you been able to say to the Prime Minister? And have you come away with anything concrete that you can take to COP?
Yes, indeed. It has been a very good visit, not only for India and Denmark and our bilateral relationship, but also for the climate. First of all, I would like to say that with the IPCC report, it should be very clear for all of us in the entire world that we have to act now and we have to make the changes faster than what we thought. We are in a very difficult situation, but also a situation with possibilities. And our responsibilities as leaders of the world is to show our population, and especially our children and young people, that we are able to ensure a green transition and at the same time support economic growth. And both things are needed in a country like India. When you ask me what are the concrete results, and do I believe that India will be able to answer the questions and to reach the ambitious targets that India has set when it comes to renewables and the Paris Agreement? The answer is actually yes, because what we see now is a very ambitious Indian government who really wants to transform electricity and the use of power into green electricity with renewables. And the partnership with Denmark, one year ago, we formed the first green strategic partnership between India and Denmark. And we have the skills and India have the size. And when it comes to renewables, this is specifically an area where Denmark has a lot of experiences, and we have a lot of specialists and companies who have the right answers. So yes, when it comes to the Indian ambitions, I think they will reach it. And if you ask Denmark, we have one of the most ambitious goals, I think, in the entire world, with a reduction of 70% in 2030. We are going to reach that target. It will be difficult. It is extremely difficult, but we have to do it. We don't have a choice not to do it.
So let me just ask you again, do you think, or did you get the impression, because India has been a bit of a laggard on this, and as you know, India, which, you know, is termed a developing country, likes to say to you all, hey, you guys, you had your industrial revolutions and your emissions and you're rich and powerful now, don't tell us that we can't do it. So did you get the impression that they're changing their minds, and particularly that the coal crisis, unprecedented coal crisis that they're about to experience, might lead them now, you know, to move away from fossil fuels? Because China, as you heard, is telling its coal companies to boost their output because of the current energy crisis.
Yes, I actually believe in India, because the mindset of Prime Minister Modi and the Indian government is a green mindset. So I actually believe that they are going to change and to make the right decision. But at the same time, I would like to underline that I think all have to respect and really understand that we have different starting points. Even though it's difficult also for Denmark to make this truly green transition and to change almost everything in our own society to reach our ambitious goals, even though it's difficult in Denmark and also in Europe, it is much easier for countries like Denmark and the most European countries to achieve these goals than it is for a country like India. And if we respect the different starting points and make partnerships like the one we have made between India and Denmark, then collectively, I think we are going to show the rest of the world that we are able to do it, because we don't have a choice not to do it. But we have to respect the different starting points, and therefore, it is also extremely important when we meet in Glasgow and for the COP26 that some of us, the richest countries, are willing to deliver when it comes to financing on climate change. Because if we want to reach the goals, some of us has to deliver more than others. And Denmark is ready to do our part also when it comes to financing.
Okay, so let me read. You say the rich countries. So Alok Sharma, who is the British president of the COP summit, says Australia are our closest mates, and I want them to come to our party and sing the same songs. And that means making ambitious commitments on emissions reductions by 2030 and obviously a net zero target. As you said, some G7 nations are lagging behind. France and Italy have not made new financial pledges on climate assistance to developing countries. So how concerned are you? I mean, you touched on it, that those pledges will be kept and that countries like Australia, you know, will get away from their coal mines and their fossil fuels and come to COP with some real commitments for the future.
My key message for you tonight is that we all have to do more. When I saw the IPCC report, it was totally clear that even countries that do a lot already, and gladly, I'm very proud that Denmark is one of those countries, even us, we have to do more. Also Australia. And I think the G20 meeting just, you know, before the high-level meeting in Glasgow is as important, actually, as the COP26, because we need G20 to show the way. If Denmark can do what we do, to set ambitious targets, to show that we are able to make concrete results, and now also give more directly in financing, then the other countries can do the same.
Mm-hmm. Prime Minister, one of the things you say and your government says is that as we have become greener, we have become wealthier. And sure, that seems to be the big panic in the countries that are climate resistance, in the quarters that are climate deniers, and in ordinary people's homes when they don't believe that they're going to be well off enough or able to support themselves if they take green measures. This story has not been told properly. What can you do and what can you say to, let's say, Prime Minister Modi or whoever you're talking to, that actually look at us, we are wealthier now that we've gone greener? And actually, can countries like India do the same?
First of all, I think we have to recognize why some people fear the green transition. Are afraid that maybe they're going to lose their jobs, or what about economic growth? Because we need economic growth and we need to create more jobs, because unemployment is a disaster in all societies. When you look at Denmark, it is exactly what you just said. We have been able to grow our economy. We are now a more rich country than we were for 40 years ago. And at the same time, we have shown that it is possible to do it in a green way. So the Danish example, or the Danish green model, is hopefully something that other countries can use as well, because we have shown that social responsibility goes hand in hand with the green transition if we insist on it. And therefore, when you look at it globally, we really need all the rich countries to step up now and to use the COP26 to tell the rest of the world that we are ready to set the ambitious targets and goals, but at the same time, we feel as responsible as we do for the climate, we feel as responsible for other dimensions as well, the social dimension, the fight against inequality, gender issues, and sustainability, because welfare and social justice has to go hand in hand with the green transition and the fight against climate change. We have shown it in Denmark, so it is possible. It is possible. It has to be possible. We don't have a choice not to deliver what we have to deliver now on this agenda.
Can I switch and ask you about your internal politics at home and actually the issue of immigration? This year alone, your administration has instituted a zero asylum policy applications. And you're also now requiring some immigrants, migrants to work 37 hours a week in order to receive welfare benefits. Some critics are worried that this will chip away at your very basis of, you know, human rights and your welfare and the general respect for immigrants.
Well, thank you also for that question. And I would like to say some different things about it. First of all, I think we have to be honest with each other that the asylum system that we know today is not longer functioning. It is only those who are able to cross the sea and to have those who have money enough or the health, they are strong enough. Today, it is primarily the smugglers who are the winners of the asylum system. And therefore, I think Europe, we have, of course, a big responsibility when it comes to refugees and asylum seekers. But we can help many more people. Many more people if we help in the neighboring regions and countries. And at the same time, we can avoid that all these people are being mistreated on the way to Europe. So asking me as a social democrat, I think it's much more human to help people in the surrounding and neighboring areas than it is to ask people to come all the way to Europe, especially when we know that a lot of them is not really asylum seekers and they will be sent back.
Thank you, Prime Minister, for joining us from New Delhi. Now, in its 138-year history, the Metropolitan Opera in New York has never hosted a performance by a black composer until now. The pandemic closed the Met for a year and a half, and it's reopened with Fire Shut Up in My Bones, which is a new opera by the six-time Grammy-winning musician and composer Terence Blanchard. His new work is based on the 2014 memoir by the New York Times columnist Charles Blow. And he's been speaking to Walter Isaacson about his artistic process.
Thank you, Christiane. And Terence Blanchard, congratulations on the opening of your opera at the Met, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Walter. Really means a lot.
You know, I was struck by the fact that you're the first black composer to do an opera at the Met, and there haven't been very many contemporary composers, and you do Charles Blow's memoir of growing up in Louisiana, just like you did. Tell me about that opera.
Well, you know, I chose it because of the notion of the isolation of him growing up in his own community and him overcoming being molested by a family member. And the other reason why I chose it is because he's still around. You know, he's still with us. You know, he can be the shining example of what happens when you stick to your guns and when you have the resilience to get through anything. And when we did the opera in St. Louis, you know, I didn't let Charles come to any rehearsals. You know, and the night of the premiere, man, I really regretted it because I was scared to death. But after the premiere was over, I walked over to him and I said, "Hey, man, are we okay?" And he said, yeah, we're good. He says, "I realize that's not me anymore." And that statement to me was one of the reasons why I wanted to do his story, because that in itself, and then he went on to write a piece about it. But that in itself could be the motivating factor for a number of kids who are probably going through something similar.
Tell me about reading Charles Blow's memoir and why you thought that would make a good opera.
Well, you know, my wife, you know, read the book. My wife, Robin Burgess, she read it and then handed it to me. And when I read it, you know, the first thing I kept thinking about, or the first thing that resonated with me, was the notion of being isolated in your own community, a community that you really wanted to belong to, you know, because I knew what that was like. You know, Walter, we grew up in a music town, but that doesn't necessarily mean all of our neighborhoods were like really supportive of that young kid walking to the bus every weekend with his horn, you know, trying to go get that lesson. You know, in my neighborhood, everybody wanted to be athletes, wanted to be, you know, football players or basketball players. And at my home, we had this big bay window in the front and the piano was right there. So when I was practicing my piano lessons, that wasn't the most popular thing to do while all of my boys were outside playing football. So, you know, I can understand what Charles was feeling in that situation. I wasn't molested by a family member, so I can't speak to that. But the whole isolationist thing was something that had a profound effect on me.
You know, but the scenes in the opera, I loved it when I saw it, but I didn't feel like I was listening to jazz. It wasn't a jazz opera. but it was an opera sort of in jazz, meaning it had a lot of the sort of syncopations and rhythms of it. Tell me, what were you aiming for? Were you trying to create a jazz opera?
No. That's why we've been calling it an opera in jazz, for that very reason. Because, you know, when I met with Opera Theater St. Louis at first thing they told me, they said, well, you know, they felt like we haven't really defined what American opera is. You know, we know what German opera, French, Italian, obviously. And they said, well, maybe American opera should have some elements of jazz in it.
I am what I am, my roots run deep. I bend, I don't break, I'm not a mistake, I'm not a child any longer. I am.
And for me, I went back to the whole notion of Stravinsky. I'll never forget when I was with Art Blakey. You know, I went to Hungary for the first time, and man, I'm walking around and I heard some young musicians on the street playing these Hungarian folk songs. And I'm sitting there going, man, they're playing Stravinsky, you know? And when I realized what was going on, it was a big education for me. So I held on to that idea for a number of years, obviously. And when it came time to do this, I said, well, that's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to use the DNA of jazz. You know, sometimes, you know, there are harmonic progressions that I'm using, but I'm not using them in a jazz setting. I'm using them more in an orchestral way. But the elements of it come from that world. Roger Dickerson told me, he said, listen, man, you're gaining this experience of writing for orchestra with in the movies. You need to start thinking about how you can incorporate the language and articulations and the rhythms and harmony of jazz and what it is that you do with orchestra. So that's what I've been doing, you know, and it's developed. It's grown into this approach of writing that, you know, makes my music sound a little different.
How did the murder of George Floyd and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, how did that affect your work?
It had a huge effect on my work because it had a huge effect on the country. You know, when that event occurred, you know, I have a lot of friends in New Orleans who are well-meaning people, you know, who saw that and, you know, started calling me and started texting me, asking me if I was okay. And I kept thinking maybe something happened to a family member of mine. And I talked to one friend, I said, well, what's going on? And he said, well, no, I just saw the video. And I realized that they finally saw what we have been talking about for generations in this country, you know, and being a captive audience around the nation because of the pandemic, I know that it had a profound effect on a lot of people. Which, you know, in turn made people feel like they needed to make some changes. So, you know, kudos to Peter Gell, because he even told me, he said that had a huge effect on him and his thinking about what he could do to stem the tide of intolerance and racism.
Peter Gell, who runs the Met, you know, recruited you to do this. Do you think there's going to be a change at the Met now that this worked out so well?
I know there is, you know, because I met two young composers who have been commissioned by Peter, one of Asian descent and one who's a female. And I think that in itself speaks to what it is that I've been saying about not wanting to be a token. I want to be a turnkey. This can't be a one-off. And I think Peter is committed to that. He's also announced that he's going to do Anthony Davis's opera about Malcolm X. So hopefully this will be a sea change in the world of opera, because, you know, we at a time when opera was struggling trying to sell tickets, you know, this opera has done extremely well. You know, we've sold out just about every show, and I think there are new people who are coming to opera. You know, as a matter of fact, you know, when we did Champion in New Orleans, there was a gentleman who walked up to me after the show in his mid-70s, and he said to me, man, if this is opera, I'll come. And that blew me away. I went, see, if we do stories that are relevant to people's lives, the way Puccini and Verdi and all those other guys did, people will probably see a feel of need to experience that. Because I've been trying to tell my friends, stop thinking of what you think opera is. You know, this is the highest form of musical theater you can ever experience.
You're an only child, and your dad loved opera. I'd love to hear you talk about rattling around the house as a young kid where your dad's trying to make you love opera.
Well, you know, it was always kind of funny, man, because in my neighborhood, you know, opera wasn't the most popular choice of music to, you know, to listen to. So when my friends would come over and my dad would be sitting in the front singing his parts to something he was working on, I would always rush him by the front room. I said, man, let's go in the back. And they said, man, what are you doing? I'm like, dude, come on, let's go. What is your dad doing? I'm like, don't worry about that. But anytime a good piece of music or opera would come on PBS or anything, he would scream across the house, hey, Terrence, come here, come here, come here, come here. And he would make me sit down and he'd make me listen to it. And he said, now, see, that's music. That's music. See, that's great music. And I hated it when I was a kid, to be honest, you know, but I grew to love the music when I became older. And I think it's just so ironic that I'm in this world right now. I know I've been telling everybody, I know he's up there looking at me going, I told you so.
The first opera in America was staged in our hometown of New Orleans. And opera's been really a part of the city tradition. Louis Armstrong used to hang out at the French Opera House in the French Quarter, listening to Puccini and others. Tell me about all the musical strands of New Orleans that come together, both in your work and in music today.
Oh, man, I can't even put it in the words. When there's so many times, you know, I hear that beat, that street beat from New Orleans and other forms of music. You know, I've talked to a friend of mine, Danilo Perez, who's from Panama, and we even talk about how it influenced Latin music. You know, Art Blakey used to talk about how the rhythm from New Orleans and the rhythm of Latin cultures is the same, just on the other side of the beat. You know, if you say one, two, three, four, one, tinkering, 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 and then in Latin music it is tinkering, tinkering, tinkering. So it's a similar beat, just on the other side of the beat. And there's so many elements from that that I hear in all different types of music, the spiritually based music, you know, Mahalia Jackson and all of the things that those people created and contributed to the world of music. We hear today, there's one aria that we do in the piece called Peculiar Grace, where Angel Blue responded to a conversation that we had the first day of rehearsal, where I told them, I said, I know a lot of you guys grew up in the church, and you're told to put that aside when you're going to sing classic opera, when you're going to sing Puccini. You can't bring that into that, right? I understand it. But here, I want you to bring all of that back to the stage. Responded in a way that is so hauntingly beautiful with this one aria that I feel very, very blessed to have all of these extremely talented people on board.
You know, in your opera, you really honor tradition. I mean, this is a very traditional form. And in jazz, you honor tradition. And yet, what you also have to do is break tradition. You have to break away from the mold. How do you balance breaking tradition with honoring tradition?
Well, the first thing is to really study the history and to know your craft. That's the first thing. Because, you know, knowing the craft, then I'll be able to say, okay, well, Stravinsky did this way, but I'm going to add this element to it. I'm going to add this type of harmonic passage to it. I'm going to add this orchestration to it, you know. And it's really interesting because, like, I love Puccini and I love the way that he writes for voice, the way sometimes he'll double the vocal line with the orchestra. So there are elements of those things that I take that are structural, right, that are not, you know, actual phrases. But I take those things and I implement them in the way that I see fit for the way that I create phrases. So that's the way of honoring the tradition, but still moving forward. You know, I always have to tell my students what Ellis Marsalis used to tell us all the time. He said, a turtle never gets nowhere unless he sticks his neck out. So, you know, you got to take a chance every now and then.
You did The Tale of God's Will, which won a Grammy, and it was a requiem for Hurricane Katrina. Tell me how Katrina, it really hit your neighborhood pretty bad, Pontchartrain Park in New Orleans. Tell me how Katrina affected your work.
Oh, it had a huge effect on my work. As a matter of fact, that album is the reason why I'm doing opera, because Jim Robinson, he told me that's one of his Desert Island albums. And it was the reason that that was the thing that made him think about me writing opera. That moment in time was something I could have never fathomed. And Walter, I was so hurt when the realization of those train tracks in my neighborhood being above the roof line in our neighborhood finally made sense. Every movie that I saw when I was a kid, train tracks were on the ground. You know, they were street level. And I never understood why the train tracks in my neighborhood were so high. And then when Hurricane Katrina came and I saw that satellite photo of my neighborhood, where the only thing I could see was water, rooftops, and those train tracks. That had a heavy effect on me in terms of how I felt betrayed, you know, by government. And, you know, it made me realize, you know, we're all in this together, because that was the beautiful side of that tragedy. When Hurricane Katrina hit that area, man, we didn't have any red or blue states. You know, everybody was on the same page trying to help anyone in need. And that really clued me into how powerful human nature is, you know, the human spirit, you know, our willingness to help our brothers when they need it, you know. And that was a turning point of what I was telling you earlier about how I wanted to create music to help people heal.
Tell me about, you've spent 30 years scoring films for Spike Lee, including When the Levees Broke, about Katrina. Tell me what it's like to work for him and scoring movies. What's that like?
Working with Spike, man, has been a godsend, because he's such a unique filmmaker that it's always challenged me. You know, I remember when I first started working with Spike, you know, he kept telling me, I don't like underscore. I want to hit melody. I want to hit themes, you know. And then sometimes, I think it was Summer of Sam, one of those early films, you know, I was talking to him about, did you show you want the theme here? Because there's a lot of dialogue here, you know. And he would tell me, you know, he got upset with me one day and he goes, listen, man, it's been scientifically proven that the brain can focus on more than one thing at one time. And I went, okay, got it. You know, but that in itself made me realize I need to figure out ways of writing these orchestrations that will carry the themes the way he wants them to, but still won't get in the way of important dialogue. And that in itself, I think, has allowed me to develop the style that people recognize in my film writing. And he's just been, I don't even know how to explain it. He's one of these guys that is so secure with what he does that he gives you room. Like, you know, when I'm working with Spike, the only thing he asked is for me to send him themes. And when I send him the themes and then he starts to assign them to characters, I literally don't hear from him until it's time to go into the studio. You know, when we did the Five Bloods, the last film, you know, I didn't hear from him until we got in the studio. And then when I got in the studio, you know, I just made sure everything was the way he loves it. I know what he likes. And I think he does that because he wants to have the reaction that an audience would have by hearing the music for the first time.
You've got a great new album out called Absence. I think Branford Marsalis, I heard one of the cuts playing Go with you on it. And it's a homage to Wayne Shorter. Tell me why.
Well, Wayne Shorter is one of our great American treasures, I think. You know, I think Wayne Shorter has been a person that has been so meaningful in my life. I know that for sure, because I learned so much from him. I didn't want to wait until he was no longer with us for me to tell him how much I love his music, how much I love him as a person and a musician, and show him that by putting this album together. And what I thought would be, you know, most interesting for him would be not to just do an album of his music, but to combine his music with original music from the guys in the band to show him, you know, how he's influenced us in our writing, you know. And it's just a love letter to Wayne Shorter because he's meant so much to so many people.
Terrence Blanchard, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Walter. It's good seeing you, man.
Inspiring and uplifting indeed. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and of course across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.